I think this is going to be an incredibly helpful topic for people. We're talking about the difference between picky eaters and problem feeders. And if you've never heard that second term, that's why you're here. Keep watching. And we'll get into really practical solutions too, because I'm all about education, but if we don't know how to apply it. So let me introduce you to my audience, Dr. Toomey. So Dr. Toomey is a pediatric psychologist, worked with children who don't eat for almost 30 years. Not that the children aren't eating for 30 years. She has 30 years of experience, but if you have one of those kids, I'm sure those words just like set fear into your heart. It's such a stressful idea, these children who don't eat. And Dr. Toomey developed the SOS approach to feeding. It's a family-centered program for assessing and treating children with these feeding problems. And she has national esteem. She speaks all over the place and is a consultant to Gerber Products, which is pretty cool. And she's even helped to form the Children's Hospital of Denver's Pediatric Oral Feeding Clinic. And just, I mean, you can tell, like, your hands are in a lot of places and a lot of states, Dr. Toomey. So again, I'm so glad to hear you here. Yes. So now you have your own feeding clinic promoting and sharing these SOS feeding solutions for 6 to 8 years.
I was at a children's hospital, and then I was at a private hospital, and then I went into private practice, and I had a couple of different private practices.
Yes. And I found Dr. Toomey because her team actually reached out to me to see if they could incorporate Kids Cook Real Food just as sort of a resource, because you have this amazing program, Dr. Toomey, and I started reading the testimonials of these children who just wouldn't eat. And even some of them are teens when they come to you.
Yes, they are.
And they've eaten like 5 foods their entire life, and your methods work. So we have got to dive right in, but let's start with the vocabulary. What's the difference between a picky eater versus a problem feeder, just so we all have the same language?
If I can, I want to step us back for just a couple of seconds and look at feeding and eating from a big global perspective, because a lot of times when children don't eat well, people think that that's a behavioral problem. And of course, as parents, when somebody tells us our kids have a behavioral problem, oftentimes what we hear is we're bad parents, or we just have a stubborn, obnoxious, willful little brat who isn't eating to make everybody mad, right? That's what we hear.
But it's a personal affront, yeah.
Behavioral problem. So the thing is, when children don't eat well, whether they're picky eaters or whether they're a problem feeder, it's because something about their body isn't quite working correctly. And eating is the only thing you do as a human being that involves all 7 areas of human function. It makes it the hardest thing you will ever do in your entire lifetime. We just all think it's easy because we've been doing it since we were babies, right? And we know there are 5 major developmental transitions in feeding across the first 10 years of your life. And if something about your body is a little bit off, including a little bit of your development being off, you're going to kind of get hit when you get to one of those developmental transition time periods. And so what happens when things aren't quite going correctly physically, developmentally, is you get to those transition time periods. Instead of sailing through them, you start to get tripped up. And so that's what creates picky eaters and problem feeders. So when kids don't eat well, it's all in their body. It is not all in their heads. And there's a lot of people out there who say, ugh, all kids are picky. They'll all outgrow it. It's just you guys as parents' fault. And what the research actually shows is that we as parents are causing our kids' picky eating or their problem feeding in only about 5 to 10% of the time. And so when we go out and teach other professionals, the first thing I tell them is, if we as professionals are assuming these kids aren't eating because of their parents, we're going to be wrong 90 to 95% of the time. So don't go there, because you're probably wrong. It's much more complicated than that. So we want to think first about what are those developmental transition time periods.
Okay, so you're saying the genesis of any sort of feeding issue, whether it's picky or problem, and yep, they're sort of on a range, is the same. It's in the body. And so that's going to dictate our solution.
Absolutely. Very good. Absolutely. So the first one is related to this idea that eating's automatic, it's instinctive, everybody does it no matter what. And actually, your appetite instinct drives your eating only for the first 4 to 6 weeks of your life. That's the only time where your appetite is the primary driver of your eating. So you can't use that as an excuse anymore for overeating as a grown-up. That, oh, it's just instinct. After 4 to 6 weeks of age, and that's the first transition, there's a lessening of the appetite instinct, and your primitive motor reflexes that you should be born with are going to take over as the primary driver of eating. And so, for example, we have grasping reflexes, suck, swallow, breathe reflexes. They're there from birth, but it's that appetite instinct that really drives it at first. And then the reflexes become the major driver. Most of us are familiar with the rooting reflex. If you stroke a baby's cheek, they will turn and open their mouth. So those reflexes are going to drive your eating until about 4 to 6 months of age. Around 4 to 6 months of age, your reflexes start to come under voluntary control. So that after 6 months of age, eating is actually a learned behavior. And you either learn to eat, you learn to not eat, you learn to kind of sort of eat. That's it. Those are your three choices.
Okay.
And so that learning is important. And we're going to come back to that when we talk about what parents can do.
Okay.
So
first transition, not to interrupt too much, but that first transition from appetite to reflexes, I'm guessing there's not a whole lot of environmental play there at all?
No, there really is not. That is driven by the baby's body. And
you can't screw that one up.
Nope. And as long as their reflexes are solid, right. And unfortunately, some of our kids born premature, their reflexes aren't solid.
Okay. So we can have a falling off of the system, yep. Even at that stage.
Yes. Yes. So when the appetite becomes less, if the reflexes aren't working as solidly as they should, you can see some difficulties start right there. The bigger age of difficulty is when you lose those reflexes for eating and you have to do it all on your own. And that's why you either learn to eat, you learn to not eat, or you learn to kind of sort of eat. And so we know that eating is a learned behavior after 6 months of age. So we need to understand what we're teaching our children. Many of us as parents come to the table being dietitians. Did my child eat enough calories? Did they get enough calcium? Are they getting enough zinc? We need parents not to come to the table being dietitians. We need them to come to the table being teachers. If their children are struggling with their eating, that means their child is learning something that's getting in the way of their eating. And oftentimes, they're learning those things because the body isn't quite doing what it's supposed to. But that's where sometimes we as parents end up contributing. So while we don't cause our kids' feeding problems for the most part, there are things we can do to make it better. And unfortunately, there are things we do that makes it worse.
Okay. Do we get to hear any practical examples at that stage?
We are. I'm going to talk about some of those. So what we want to think about as we talk about picky eaters versus problem feeders is that the kids who are really having very mild issues, they're the ones who are going to learn to kind of sort of eat a little bit. But oftentimes, they're going to do it in very specific ways. Like they don't want to chew anything that's really hard to chew. And so they avoid what we call real meat. Now, when I talk about real meat, I mean like a breast of chicken, a pork chop, a steak. I don't mean chicken nuggets, fish sticks, hot dogs, bologna.
I think we're on the same page there.
We call those pre-chewed meat because the manufacturer chops them up somewhere in the plant, makes them into whatever shape they want, and throws some breading on it, even better. So, but when kids are struggling with their chewing, those foods they're going to gravitate to because they've been pre-chewed.
They're easy. We all gravitate toward what's easy at a certain point.
Exactly. Yep. So if I'm having some sensory difficulties, for example, where I don't like the way certain things feel, like things that are maybe wet, I think are slimy. And so now I'm not going to want to do the applesauce. I'm not going to want to do spaghetti sauce on my pasta. I'm not going to want to do yogurt or things like that, that we do want our kids to eat, but it's a sensory issue because they don't like the way it feels. Sometimes it's a taste issue where they don't like what the taste is. We all have different kinds of taste preferences. And we know that many vegetables are actually bitter. And not only are they bitter, but they're also stringy and very fibrous. And so vegetables have a double whammy against them because they can have a sensory issue for kids and they can have a chewing issue for kids. It's one of the reasons why we asked you if we could use your program as one of our resources, because you do such a lovely job of helping kids how to cook different things to make them taste good and make them easier to chew and work well in their mouths. And yeah, so
that, try to make it so easily accessible.
Right. That's what we love about your program. But those are some things for parents to think a little bit about when their kids are rejecting a food. What is it about the food that's the problem? Not what is it about my child that's necessarily the problem, but what is it about the food that's hard for my child? And is there a match between what works well for my child and a mismatch between what I'm trying to feed them as a parent? And that's one of the places we as parents can kind of get ourselves tripped up. So if our kids' development, if something about their body isn't quite working right, and we are trying to feed them really hard to chew foods that are super bitter, the kids are going to reject them. And then we begin to start to have this power struggle. And the next big time in development where kids' feeding can really start to falter and fall off is around 12 to 14 months when kids become self-aware. And once they become self-aware, they figure out they have an opinion they can express. So we may want them to eat one kind of food and they've decided that's too hard for their body. And now we have some headbutting going on. And unfortunately, it just gets worse in the terrific twos. And so that's our next big developmental transition time point is 2 to 3 years of age. The next one's going to be around 5 to 6, and the next one's actually going to be around 9, 10. So unfortunately, we're not out of the woods until our kids turn into preteens, early teenagers.
Then we have all of that set of power struggle problems.
I know. So that's why we think about picky eaters versus problem feeders. What we know from the research is, A, not all kids are picky. What the research shows is only about a third of children are actually going to develop picky eating. Unless you're talking about your terrible twos, in the 2 to 3 year age range, 50% of kids are going to struggle with picky eating. And it's because developmentally, it's one of those big transition time periods. But for the most part, on average, about a third of kids are going to struggle with picky eating. So it's not that all kids are picky. And it's not also true that all kids outgrow their picky eating. Only about 25% of kids who have picky eating actually outgrow it. And it's because we as parents aren't understanding what's driving their picky eating. And so we can't be as helpful as what we would like to be. Now, what the research also shows is about 5 to 10% of kids will be problem feeders and struggle with problem feeding. And so the problem feeding kids are the kids who have bigger developmental issues, bigger physical problems. And that's why it tips them over into problem feeding. So you have, I'm hoping, a picture that we can put up for families to look at what the difference between picky eating and problem feeding is. Or is it something that you're going to have them download?
Yes. So we have a chart from Dr. Toomey that everyone can download. We'll have that integrated in our post at Kids Cook Real Food. And while you're talking, Dr. Toomey, I think, pull that up and screen share.
Oh, that would be marvelous if you could do that. I think that would be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. So just to kind of recap what you're saying, what I'm hearing you say is that, first of all, picky eating and problem feeding are different levels. Problem feeding, I would say, is more severe.
Correct.
And if you put all the kids, like if you take 100% of kids and take all the picky and problem feeders, now we're like above 40% of all kids have some issues, right? Because you said a third are generally picky. And
unfortunately, the way that the research looks at it is it looks at it predominantly only from the picky eater statistics standpoint. And so what happens is that third of kids that are picky eaters, what we find when you do longitudinal studies is they stay picky for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Those children who are staying picky and not outgrowing their picky eating, those are the kids who are really going to be your problem feeders.
Oh, okay.
So it's more that it's a third of kids are going to struggle with some kind of what probably should be called feeding issue.
Got it. It's not accumulative. The problem are inside the picky third.
Right, right.
Okay.
And then 5 to 10% of those kids are going to be the problem feeders. And there will be a percent of the classic picky eater who will outgrow it, but only about 25% of the classic picky eater will actually outgrow it.
Got it. Got it. That makes sense. And I do have, hopefully that's working, screen sharing the picky eaters versus problem feeders.
So one of the big things that differentiates if a child's a picky eater versus a problem feeder is how many foods the child eats on a regular basis. And one of the things we suggest parents do, and you can do this even as we're talking here or after the program, is to take a piece of paper and put three columns on it. You're going to put proteins on one column, starches on another, fruits and vegetables in the third. And you're going to put on that list every food that your child eats on a regular basis. So they don't have to eat a lot of it. 2 to 3 bites, 80 to 90% of the time is good enough to go on the list. But what we need parents to understand is kids don't think about foods based on the food name. They think about foods as being same or different based on the oral motor skills that are needed to eat that food and the sensory features of that food. So for a child, we don't want parents on this list to just put down chicken. Because if you put down chicken, well, a chicken nugget is a completely different food to a kid than chicken lunch meat. And that's completely different than chicken Kiev or chicken Parmesan or, you know, just a plain baked chicken breast. Those are all completely different foods to kids. A saltine cracker is actually a different food than a town cracker. A saltine cracker is square. It's white, yellow, it shatters in your mouth, and it's really salty. A town cracker is oval, it's kind of orangish, yellowish, it's buttery, and it melts in your mouth. A Pringles potato chip is a very different food to a kid than a Kettle potato chip. Corn on the cob is a completely different food than polenta. So we need parents to put the exact food on this list. Freeze-dried strawberries are a different food than dried strawberries, and that's a different food than fresh strawberries.
Wow.
And that's a different food than strawberry shortcake.
Yeah. You know, I can literally see and feel the light bulbs going off all around the country right now and parents going, oh my goodness, I've always wondered why my kid doesn't just like chicken, all chicken. They only eat this kind and not this kind. And I've all, you know, I can hear my own voice saying to my kids, but you like this. It's the same thing as this.
No,
you know?
It's not.
It's not. You like lasagna. It's the same thing. It's spaghetti. No, it's the same stuff. So this is like, it's like mind opening. So I hope everyone's listening.
It all depends on how much it takes to chew it and what it feels like, smells like, tastes like, right? In the mouth. There are other senses involved. Most of us forget how foods sound in our head actually makes a difference. We have kids in our program who won't eat, and they'll tell you they won't eat that food because it's too noisy in their head. But the big ones we think about is how does it look? How does it smell? How does it taste? How does it feel in our mouth, right? And so if those things are really different, a child may eat strawberries in this form, but not in this form, right? Or dried mango is a heck of a lot easier to eat than actually fresh mango for some kids who don't like wet, slimy things. Gotcha. But if I can't chew very well, a fresh mango is going to be much easier for me to manage than a dried spear of mango, right?
Sure. And so, I think all of us adults, too, we have our preferences like that. Like, I will never eat canned green beans, but I'll eat frozen sautéed. But if they get too cooked, then I don't like them anymore, right? Like, we do this, too, as adults.
We do.
So are we looking for categories, then, on this? Categories of sensation?
No, but it's this first one is really for parents to make sure they're really and truly writing down every single solitary food individually, separately, that their child eats.
Hey, parents and grandparents, do you wish that your kids would help out a little more around the house and maybe eat their vegetables? Let me tell you that knowing how to cut up produce is the key to making both of those happen. Our members' favorite cooking class year over year is our 10-minute knife skills and safety video. In that video, we teach kids ages 2 to teen how to hold a knife and how to hold the food. We use fun phrases like up and over soldier and hey, hey, out of the way that build a common vocabulary for your family to safely use knives, both with parent participation and later independently. It is an incredible skill for your kids to have. And you know what? I would like to give that training video to you for free. Just go to kidscookrealfood.com/free-knife-skills. That's kidscookrealfood.com/free-knife-skills. If you can't find it, just go to the homepage and click preview in the menu. It's right there all the time because we love building independence in the kitchen for kids. And I firmly believe that if you support real food, that means knife skills. Now back to the podcast.
Now, if your child eats kids' cereal, we are only going to give them 1 point if they're eating Trix and Kix and Sugar Pops. You know, we hope our kids aren't eating that, but that is what some kids gravitate to.
Sure.
You only get 1 point for that, okay? Because they're pretty
good score.
They all taste the same. They all work the same in your mouth. They melt in your mouth, and they're all sweet. So it's more thinking about just how similar it is. If you eat, you know, chicken anytizer kinds of things that are strips of chicken nugget, and you eat round chicken nuggets and dino chicken nuggets, you only get 1 point for chicken nuggets.
Got it. So, although there are some kids who will only eat the dinos.
There are. Yeah. And we can talk about those kids later. That's a visual issue. But on this first list, we really want every single food, because most of us as parents think our children eat less than what our children actually do. And we think our kids have fewer foods in their food range than what they actually do. And kids who are picky eaters, once you count up all the foods on that list, you're going to see about 30 foods. And we got to make sure parents remember all the dairy products, all the egg products, nuts, seeds, beans, black beans, lentils, all those things are proteins, right? Mm-hmm. Fish. So we don't want parents to forget about foods either. But when you count up the foods on the list, the kids who are problem feeders generally have under 20 foods in their food repertoire when you do your list.
Yeah.
So that's going to be one of the things that differentiates. And I would recommend parents just go ahead and circle which one of these things best fits their child.
On this chart.
So we know that when kids' sensory systems aren't working very well, one of the things they want to do is something called a food jag. And a food jag is when your child wants to eat the same exact food prepared the same exact way over and over and over again. And the reason why they do that is because if you make me my perfect isosceles triangle grilled cheese sandwich, no crust, lightly toasted, no black specks, no brown specks, only one slice of only the orange Kraft American cheese, not lucernes, not the yellow, not two slices at 98.6 degrees.
Yep.
I don't have to turn on my sensory brain to eat that food, do I? So kids' food jag during those developmental transition time periods, 4 to 6 months, 12 to 14 months, 2 to 3, 5 to 6, 9 to 10, because those part of those transition times are times when the sensory systems don't work as well. And when your sensory systems aren't working very well, it's a lot easier for me to fuss at my parent and get my parent to make me a perfect food than it is to work my sensory brain to eat that food.
It's like it's overly taxing at those stages.
It is. It's hard. And so, and sometimes as adults, we forget that kids are organized more simply than we are. We forget that if it hurts, they cry, right? If they're mad, they throw it on the floor. If they don't like something, they scream. If they don't like someone, they try to hit them. If it's hard work, little kids either run away or they cheat. And one of the ways to cheat is by fussing at you, my parent, and getting you to make me easier food. Now, I know we all know adults who still function at that level. However, after about 7, we should be overcoming some of that.
Okay.
But the problem with food jagging is for any of us, if we eat a food too many times in a row, too close together, we're eventually going to get sick and tired of that food, right? That's why a lot of us as grownups, you know, have 3 half-eaten boxes of adult cereal in our cupboards, because you get about a box and a half in and you get sick of that one, and then you got to switch to something else.
Mm.
But for those of us who are not problem feeders, those of us who are typical eaters and picky eaters, if we take about a 2-week break from a food, we'll come back and eat it again. That is not what problem feeders do. If problem feeders burn out on a food, if you give them a 2-week break, they will either act like they've never seen it before in their entire lifetime, even if they've just been living on peanut butter and honey sandwiches and wheat bread for the last 3 years as school lunch, they will act like they've never seen it before. Or they will act like it is the most disgusting thing on the planet you could ever feed them.
And the parents' heads just exploded because that's like just feels crazy to us.
Yeah. How can you do that? So what happens with problem feeders is oftentimes they started out when they were younger with more foods in their food repertoire, but then they burn out on pancakes, and then they burn out on macaroni and cheese, and then they burn out on chicken nuggets. And pretty soon we have a child who's 3, 4, 5, who only has 20 foods that they're eating, even if they were eating more when they were younger. And it's because of this food jagging and the burnout.
Okay.
And we're going to come back to that, because one of the things we don't want to do as parents is ever let our kids food jag. So kids who are picky eaters, they will eat at least one food from every nutrition and texture group. Even if their only puree is applesauce, they at least have one. Even if their only fruit is applesauce, they at least have one, right?
Okay.
Even if their only starch is bread, even if their only protein is peanut butter, they've got one in each of the nutrition, each of the texture groups. With kids who are problem feeders, they will actually avoid entire categories of fruits and vegetables, or it won't eat a single food that's crunchy. They won't eat anything that's hard to chew. They're missing entire groups of foods. And that's one of the things you'll see when you look at the list that we've had our parents make, right? Is if they're missing entire categories of food.
Okay.
With a picky eater, if you give them a new food, they're going to fuss at you. They're going to be meh, meh, meh. But they'll settle down and they'll eventually be okay. Maybe they won't eat it, but they'll be okay with it on their plate. Not happy, but they're okay. Mm-hmm. That is not what problem feeders do. If you give a problem feeder food that they don't want or they don't like, or a new food, they have what we call nuclear meltdowns. So they throw, they cry, they scream, they crawl under the table, they leave the kitchen. That's something you're going to see those kids do. For picky eaters, oftentimes at a mealtime, they will sit and eat with us or their siblings, but they want some different kinds of foods. So everybody else is eating the lasagna, and their lasagna noodle is plain with just butter and Parmesan cheese on it. Or everyone else is eating the spaghetti and their noodles are plain with butter and Parmesan cheese. So mm-hmm. They'll usually eat with us, but they're eating something a bit different. With kids who are problem feeders, they won't even eat with you. They don't want to eat with you. They want to eat by themselves. A lot of times they're not even eating at a table. They're not eating in the kitchen. A lot of these kids eat in front of the television in the living room.
That's a choice. Is that something parents should try to curb, or is it a more of a symptom rather than a cause?
It can be both. Okay. Oftentimes what happens to us as parents, because we're so desperate to get our kids to eat, we start doing all sorts of things that is a short-term fix that creates a long-term problem.
Yep.
And letting our kids watch television, play on the iPhone, play on the iPad is a short-term fix that actually creates a long-term problem. Because if your child's constantly using the iPad or watching television or reading a book, what they're laying down brain pathways for during the meal is the book or the TV show. They're not laying down brain pathways for eating the foods you want them to eat. So we don't want families using those distractors. Now, that said, if your child's learned to eat by using a distractor, we don't want you to cut them off the distractor cold turkey either.
Mm.
You got to wean them off using the distractor. And it's a long, slow process. So
I can believe that. I like to talk to parents about mindful eating and how we should be thinking about what we're eating and experiencing it. And so that's okay. So that's kind of the solution. But if you're already stuck in the bad habit of screens or devices, pull them off slowly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you were exactly right. Again, it's one of the things we love about what you do is that it is important that children be mindful eaters as well as adults. And as adults, we need to be mindful eaters so we're not overeating.
Right. But it's different for kids.
It is different.
It is. Okay.
They need to be mindful eaters because they're still learning about food. And mindful eating in a child helps them actually learn about food. And instead of building one pathway for hot dogs in their brain, by doing mindful eating, they are building a complex of brain pathways so that they can eat any food on the planet, not just hot dogs. So that's why we love mindful eating for kids. And it's a great thing that you guys advocate. If we look at our picky eaters as parents, when we talk to our child's physician, sometimes we're going to be telling the doc, yeah, I can't get them to hardly eat, but maybe the next time we go in to see the doc, we're like, nah, they're doing better. And then the next time they're picky again. And then the next time they're okay. That's what we see with picky eaters. With problem feeders, every single time we're going to the well child check, we're like, we can't get this kid to eat. This child won't eat what we want them to. They're not eating enough. It's like constant and chronic that we're saying that. A lot of times we're saying, grandma can't get them to eat. The nanny can't get them to eat. They won't eat at school. Those are the kids who are going to be our problem feeders.
Sure.
And then the last step really has to do with learning to eat new foods. People think the way we eat is a two-step process. You sit down, you eat. That's actually not true. There are 32 steps in the process of learning to eat a new food.
32. That is 32. Impressive.
Now, kids who are really typically developing have no physical problems, no developmental issues. They can sometimes learn to eat a new food in 20 to 25 steps. And that's what the picky eaters will do as well. So they can skip some of those 32 steps. Kids who are problem feeders can't. And in fact, many times it's not only at least 32, but if your child, for example, is on the autism spectrum, your child likely has 40 to 60 steps in their process of learning to eat a new food. So the key to looking at picky eaters versus problem feeders, of course, is that if your child falls in the problem feeder range, they need to go into feeding therapy.
Right. There's no at-home solution. It's just too big. It's too big of
It is too big. You really want to find a feeding therapist in your community and get yourself and them some help. And in our clinic, we talk to the kids and the parents about it's not just kids who are in food school. Moms and dads are in food school too. And so it's both. Your picky eaters as long as we think about how we set up our meals, what we serve them for meals, we as parents can actually help our children, to the best of their physical and developmental abilities, outgrow their picky eating.
This is very exciting, and I'm also slightly terrified because I've been teaching people how to raise more adventurous eaters and combat picky eating and the power struggles at the table, and some of the things that you have said are not true have totally come out of my mouth. So I'm humble enough to change that presentation at this point, but I'm now nervous how much am I going to have to change it.
Yeah. So the first most important thing, and the majority of us as parents don't even think about this, that we can do to help our children who are struggling with eating is get them in the correct seated position at meals. And here's the reason why. Because people think that in the body's list of priorities, eating is number one. Number one is not, eating is not your number one priority. Breathing is your number one priority, obviously, because if you can't breathe, you will not be alive. So breathing is number one. And what I like to talk to families about is I want you to think about the last time you had a really bad head cold. How you eat a little bit and then you have to stop and breathe, right? And then you eat a little bit more, eat a little bit more. And after about three times of doing that, you're like, yeah, I'm not doing this anymore. Yeah. I can't breathe. I can't smell. I can't taste. This isn't worth it. And that's actually what kids who have chronic congestion do. Kids who have environmental allergies. Kids who have chronic sinus infections. Kids who have asthma.
And food allergies. I know
food allergies really causes a lot of congestion. Absolutely. Food allergies, food sensitivities, food intolerances. Those things are going to actually interfere with your breathing. Children who have respiratory disorders like cystic fibrosis, children who have cardiac issues, their blood isn't supplying enough oxygen out into the body because the cardiac system isn't pumping it like it should. So those kids are all going to struggle with eating because breathing is your number one priority. Oxygenation of the body is the number one priority. Now, people think eating is your second priority. No, it's not. Protecting the brain and not falling on your head is your second priority. So what we in the therapy field call postural stability. And so you only have so much motor brain power available at any one time to do tasks. And if you are using up all your motor brain power to make sure you're posturally stable and not going to fall and hit your head, you're not going to have very much motor brain power left over to make your mouth work correctly, to make your hands work correctly. So this lack of postural stability not only interferes with eating, it also interferes with your children doing their homework correctly, because we put them in child-size desks, tables, chairs at school where they're seated in the right position. We bring them home and put them in adult chairs where they're not in the right position.
So their body and their brain are sort of spending too much energy figuring out how to not fall off the chair, how to be comfortable.
Exactly. And that's why your kids sit on their knees. That's why they wiggle and squiggle. That's why they put one little butt cheek on the chair and one foot on the floor. And because the correct seated position for any of us, even as adults, is what we call a 90-90-90 position. 90 degrees at the hips, 90 degrees at the knees, 90 degrees at the ankles, which means your feet need to be flat on the floor. And we make most children sit for 20 to 40 minutes at a meal with no foot support. If you are not grounded, you are at risk for falling on your head. And your body is going to spend all sorts of time to make sure you're not going to fall on your head and you're not going to be working your mouth. So the first most important thing parents can do is get their child in a 90-90-90 position. And so that means they're going to have to bring their child forward in the adult chair, give them a supportive backrest so the child's knees fall over the front edge of the chair, because adult chairs are too long for children from butt to knee. And then you're going to have to give them a foot rest in addition to that, so they have a place for their feet, because adult chairs are too long from knee to ankle for children. I want your audience to think about the last time you went to a restaurant that had tall top tables, or you maybe are out at a bar and it's a very tall bar and you get the bar stool that has no rung to it. How does that feel? What do you do as an adult? Well, first you start leaning forward, you lean backwards, you turn around, you put one butt cheek on the chair, one foot on the floor, and pretty soon you're standing up because you're like, this is too much of a pain, right? And that's what kids do as well. That's why kids want to stand and eat. That's why they want to walk around and eat, is because if I'm standing, I can lock up my ankles, my knees, my hips, and have my upper body free to feed myself, and I'm not worrying about falling on my head. So you can make your own seating adjustments. Every 3 months, you're going to have to adjust all the pieces because
kids are growing.
Growing. And not from butt to knee and knee to ankle. So one of the things we actually recommend in our clinic, especially for problem feeders, is that parents consider purchasing the adjustable wooden chairs that are out there.
Okay. And I've ever seen these. Are they kind of a niche item?
It depends on where you're located. So one is called the Trip Trap Chair, TRIPPTRAPP, Trip Trap Chair, by a company by the name of Stokey. There's one that's called the Height Right Chair or the Kikaroo Chair by a company called Special Tomato. There are other companies who make them, but you have to make sure if you're going to buy an adjustable wooden chair that it's fully adjustable, that the seat on the chair is adjustable up and down, forward and back, and the footrest is adjustable up and down, forward and back.
Okay.
Because the other thing about children sitting at adult tables is the correct height for your child at the table is for the table surface to hit halfway between the belly button and the breast nipples. So we don't want your children's chin on the table, and we don't want the table on their lap.
Right.
The correct table surface is halfway between the belly button and the breast nipple. So the other thing you're going to have to do is put your child on some kind of hard cushion. Mm-hmm. So not like a pillow, but like a couch cushion.
Why not a pillow?
Because it's too squishy and wobbly and wiggly.
Okay.
You need something firm and solid. Like if you go to Joann's or a sewing store, a hobby store, Michael's, they will have hard foam that you would use if you were going to make couch cushions. That makes great seat elevators for your kids. It works well as a backrest for your child. But a step stool is going to work best as the footrest.
Okay.
It's just you're going to have to buy every 3 months all new pieces of it if you don't get an adjustable chair. So,
oh goodness. If your kids grow that fast, mine stay little. But just to clarify, is this just for picky eaters, problem feeders, or should every parent be doing this?
Okay. Every parent should be doing that.
That's what's blowing me away, because you don't see these chairs out at Lowe's and Home Depot. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to really search for them.
If you look at them, I bet you Lowe's and Home Depot have them. You've probably seen them, but you've probably walked past them.
Didn't know what they were.
Those people are focused on high chairs. And these adjustable wooden chairs actually can be used as high chairs.
Okay.
And we recommend that parents don't buy high chairs. Because your child should be in a high chair only from about 7 months to about 14 months. So many people spend an awful lot of money on high chairs when their children shouldn't be in them for very long. The adjustable wooden chairs can be used from the time your child is sitting up really well, up straight at meal, about 7 months, until about 10 years of age.
Wow. So all of the parents with very young children are extremely fortunate to be hearing this conversation at this point, because they have the most to save in their budget.
It is one of the best things you can do for your kids, is get them in the 90-90-90 position. And it is amazing that it's not better known. But it's in part because people don't understand how complicated eating is.
Absolutely not. No. Now, let's say, so I don't have that chair today. I'm going to feed my children in a few hours.
Yep.
Is it better to have them with their feet curled under, to just let them stand so that I'm worried about falling, to put them at like our child-sized table, even if it's not a perfect fit?
Yeah, in some ways, it would be better for them to sit at the child-sized table and for you to sit with them to have their meal. The challenge with the child-sized table is it's really easy to run away. And we prefer that you families to make the adjustments and have them up at the adult table, because whatever adjusted chair you're going to put them in is going to be a little trickier for them to get away from. And so they're more likely to stay in their chair as a result of that. But today, because you don't have those things purchased, having them sit in the child-sized chair is good. But the second most important thing you can do as a parent to help your child eat better is to eat with them directly and be a good role model. And we know this from the research too. If you're in the kitchen with your child and you want them to eat a new food, but you're not sitting at the table, they will not eat the new food. If you're sitting at the table with them eating a different food than the new food you want them to eat, they also will not eat the new food. The only time kids eat new foods is when you, as the grown-up, are sitting and eating the new foods. So if you want your child to eat more fruits and vegetables, you as a grown-up need to cook more fruits and vegetables and eat more fruits and vegetables. Because being a good role model is the second most important thing you can do as a parent.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. And at least I got that one right. Am I correct in saying that having your feet grounded, whether it's on a stool rest or the actual ground, is that the proprioceptive sense that you're kind of balancing yourself?
Very good.
We did an interview with, I think it's Melanie Pouchak, and her the 8 senses of feeding. So that's right. One we'll definitely link to from the description.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
Yes, most definitely. And Melanie actually trained with us. That grounding is part of that proprioceptive sense. So the other option for you, if you don't want to put the kids or you don't want to sit at the child-sized chair, because it's hard as a grown-up to sit in those little baby chairs, is at a minimum, if the only thing that you can do is pull out one of your step stools from somewhere in the house and at least ground their feet. That's kind of the minimum thing that you could do. Okay. Most of us have 2 or 3 step stools, right? Somewhere in the house. Just pull one of them out and put a step stool under their feet. That's a good start if there's nothing else that you can do.
Yeah, so interesting. But better seated than standing. Because some of my kids do they get that one butt cheek on and then they're standing. I say, it's not a battle I'm going to fight.
Right.
But there are probably other problems with eating standing up.
Right.
Your nervous system and stuff.
Well, and if you're standing, you can run away easily. So again, it doesn't help the kids stay at the table.
Yeah.
So the correct seated position not only helps them feel grounded, but it keeps them at the table. And of course, we need them to be at the table in order to eat and stay at the table in order to eat enough, right?
Yeah. And I know it's a problem. That was when I started doing these presentations on adventurous eating. I would ask people, what are you dealing with at the table? And the two that came up the most that just blew my mind, because it's not been my experience, was kids just literally running around, leaving the table, and the screens, and the fact that they've fallen into a habit of using the devices as a crutch during feeding. And I thought, oh, goodness, this is these are a big deal.
So one of the reasons why children leave the table is because they're not posturally grounded.
Mm-hmm.
The second most biggest reason why children leave the table is because they're not sure they can handle either the oral motor part of the food, or they can't handle the sensory parts of the food.
So the fight or flight in their psychology.
Exactly.
They're like, I'm out of here.
So what they do is leave. So the third most important thing we can do as a parent is structure our meal times. And we want to structure our meal times to help our kids get to the table and stay at the table and be adventurous eaters. And so having a routine to meals is going to be the third most important thing we can do.
Just a super quick interruption. You're a parent, so I know you're used to those. I wanted to make sure that you knew what we do here at Kids Cook Real Food. The name does kind of give it away. We teach kids to cook real food. Yes, here at the Healthy Parenting Handbook, I'm all about building your toolbox as a parent to raise healthy, independent adults. But at Kids Cook Real Food, I'm all about building your child's toolbox of basic cooking skills. We build over 30 basic cooking skills in our e-course for kids ages 2 to teen. When your kids have a toolbox full of skills, they can make any recipe they come across. This is not about knowing recipes. This is about building a great relationship with food and building the skills they need to access real food their entire lives. Be sure to go to kidscookrealfood.com and grab the freebie we've always got on the homepage.
And unfortunately, many of us don't have a routine to our meal. We tell our kids it's time to eat. You pick them up out of their toys, stick them in their chair, and now they're crying because they weren't ready. You know, we have to give our kids time to transition away from an activity. So the beginning part of a meal should be a verbal warning. We're going to eat in 5 minutes. When the 5 minutes are up, I actually don't recommend that you say it's time to eat now, because kids need a chance to transition from the play over here to the eating over here, because eating is the hardest thing that they will ever do. And so what we want is to give them a transition activity. And the transition activity we prefer is hand washing, because it gives them a chance to get used to the idea that I'm going to the table. It's a very nice hygiene habit to get them into, and it gets their hands ready to do this eating task. So when the 5 minutes are up, we say it's time to wash our hands now. And you have them go to the sink, crawl up on the step stool if they need to, and wash their hands. And then they can go to the table. So we're slowing down the process a little bit, giving their brain a chance to shift gears and getting their hands ready. So we've already got a big chunk of preparation happening just simply by a verbal warning and hand washing.
Yeah. Sounds to me like setting the table and being involved in the food would also involve that transition.
Phenomenal. On the table, we want a placemat, and we want plain, boring placemats because I want the food to be more interesting than the placemat. But we like placemats for everybody, including the grownups, because a placemat defines your personal space. And so it gives kids a visual cue of their personal space. On top of the placemat should be an empty plate. We need our families to go back to family style serving. And family style serving is a key part of teaching your kids to learn to eat new foods. If you serve up their plate at the counter of the stove and there's a new food on it with their preferred food and you put that down in front of them, depending on their cognitive age, you may have just contaminated their preferred food with this asparagus and now I'm not eating anything at all. Plus, if you just hand me a plate that has asparagus on it and I don't like it or where it's a new thing, you are going to send me into fight or flight, right?
Wow.
If you put it in front of me on a plate, I think I have to eat it as a kid. And if I'm not sure that I can eat it, I'm going to start getting stressed. When we stress our kids out at meals and put them into fight or flight, we've turned on their adrenaline. The problem with adrenaline at mealtimes is adrenaline turns off your appetite and it shuts down your digestive system, both. So the more we stress our kids at meals, the more we're making the eating worse because we've turned off their appetite and they're not going to digest if they have eaten something because we've turned off the gut. So family style serving is, again, slowing the process down. So what I do as a parent is I want to start in the meal serving what my child's favorite food is first, to set them up for success. So we're not putting on the fight or flight. We're having noodles, spaghetti noodles. We're having spaghetti for dinner. I'm going to take some noodles and you have plain noodles. I'm going to take some noodles and put them on my plate. here, Joseph, you can have some noodles, put them on your plate, and then pass some to your sister. And we have some Parmesan cheese we can put on our noodles, and then you pass that around. And now we have spaghetti sauce we can put on our noodles. And we have a little bowl of spaghetti sauce that we can use a small, little mini fun baby ladle and scoop it onto our noodles. What if Joseph doesn't like spaghetti sauce? What if he doesn't want to put any spaghetti sauce on his noodles? What we tell him is, that's okay. If you're not ready for the spaghetti sauce to go on your noodles, you could put some on your plate. If he doesn't want it on his plate, we could say, well, let's get a little bowl and we'll put it on your placemat. And you could put some spaghetti sauce on your placemat. When he passes it to his sister, even if he never eats that food, what he has done is he's learned to tolerate it on his plate or in his personal space. He interacted with it. He's getting some smell. And if it's a food you might serve with your fingers, he might have even learned about how it felt. So even if he didn't actually eat it, he's learning about 15 of the steps on the step to eating hierarchy.
Wow.
Just simply by doing family style serving.
That's amazing. And yeah, I talk a lot about what I call the exposure bucket of just that the smells and the feels and the interaction with the food helps. So I like the way you said it, though. Train them that it's okay to eat.
And it's one of the reasons why we love kids to cook. And it's one of the reasons why we love your program, because we know that smell, the sight, the touching helps learn those early steps on the steps to eating hierarchy. But there is a cognitive component that comes into play when you're sitting at the table and the food comes onto your plate, right?
Okay.
And that cognitive component is, now there's an expectation that I have to eat it. And so at the stove, at the counter, I don't have to eat that food. So it's easier to learn about that food at the counter in the stove than it is when it gets to the table, unfortunately. And the family style serving helps them take that process and slow it down so they'll learn. So the third part of the routine, after everybody's done eating, is to have a cleanup routine. Because many of us don't have an end to our meals. The kids either have to stay at the table until his boring old grown-ups are done talking. And especially if I don't have time sense, I don't know when that is. So I think it's going to be interminable torture. So why come to the table in the first place if I have to just stay till those boring grown-ups are done talking? Or our kids take one bite and say, I'm done, and they run away. Mm-hmm. So we need to have a cleanup routine to the end of our meals. And we're the grown-ups. We're in charge of when cleanup is.
Thank you for reminding us of that. Yes.
So if your child tries to get down too early, you're going to say, hey, we haven't done cleanup yet. You need to come back and finish your meal and we'll do cleanup. So obviously, if your child's really overwhelmed, you don't want to make them wait an hour to do cleanup, right?
Right.
But the cleanup routine is their job is to either at the table, if you're okay with it, have them clean off their plate into a compost bin or a scraps bowl or the trash, or to bring their plate to the counter and to do that. And that includes whatever got set on either a bowl or a separate plate or even directly on the placemat. That has to be picked up and cleaned up too.
Yeah.
So we're keeping the kids at the table by letting them move the food away from themselves if they're not ready for it, versus themselves away from the food.
Excellent.
And we're teaching them to stay at the table until this cleanup routine happens. It takes about 2 weeks for human beings to learn new routines. So the first 2 weeks will be, a little bit chaotic.
Right.
But after 2 weeks, when your child tries to get down and it's not cleanup time yet, you can say, you need to come back to the table. We haven't done cleanup time. And they will come back to the table. Now, usually they're going to sit down with a big sigh and eye rolling. but they're back at the table and they can do their cleanup. And then that cleanup not only is really nice for you as a parent, so that you're not doing all the dishes all by yourself.
Exactly.
But for young kids, they're socialized early. What goes in the trash stays in the trash, right? So if I get to put it in the trash, I'll touch it with my hand. I might even put it in my mouth and blow it in the trash just because that's funny. And now I've either touched it or tasted the food. And now we're up to like step 25 on the steps of learning about this food.
I love that this is such a win-win-win. We're having good feeding habits, good hygiene habits. Parents are sharing responsibility with the kids. Kids are learning to serve. We have routines. I mean, it's the whole package of how we want to raise successful adults.
Now, let's say you're having something really tough for kids at a meal, and you're going to have something like liver and onions because it's got great iron in it, right?
Sure.
And you know your child's going to have a hard time having that liver and onions on their plate or even on their placemat. We would actually potentially introduce a concept we call the learning plate into a meal. And the learning plate is a blank, empty plate that sits in the middle of your table. And if there's a food your child really can't handle in their personal space, they are allowed to put it on the learning plate and then pass the food on. So even if it goes on the learning plate and doesn't get it eaten, they still got the vision steps, the interacts with steps, the smell steps. And then your job as the parent, because it is the learning plate, it is not the ignoring plate, is to do some teaching about the food that went on the learning plate. And then your child's job at the end of the meal is to clean off what went on the learning plate, as well as their own plate, their own placemat. So they're going to get one more learning experience, right, about that food. So I think about the other most important thing for parents to do to help their kids at mealtimes is to think about not being a dietitian, but instead think about being a teacher.
Okay.
When they're planning the meal, when they're cooking the meal, that's when they can think like a dietitian, right? About what is the nutrition content of the meal I'm putting together. But once you get to the table, we need to have families think about being a teacher. If your child's a picky eater, it's because they're learning to only kind of sort of eat. So you need to teach them how to eat. That means you are the professor, mom and dad. Your child is the student, food is your subject, and every meal is class. And coming to the table thinking like a teacher is going to make all of your mealtime experiences so much better for everybody involved. Because when you come to the table, it's about learning to eat, not about how much volume you eat. It's about learning to eat a wide variety of foods. It's about learning to be an adventurous eater and enjoying being an adventurous eater, right? That's what meals are about. It's about learning. It's not just about the volume that the child eats. And what we want to think about is who are the best professors that you've had? Is the best professor you've had the one who says, sit down, be quiet, don't do it like this, do it like that, you're not doing it right, do it this way? No, the best professor you've had is the one who gets in there, does it with you, has fun, makes it funny, makes it interesting, piques your curiosity. That's who a good teacher is, right? And that's what we want parents to think about. They can be that dietitian up at the stove and the counter. Yeah. But when they come to the table, I tell parents, it's show and tell time.
So we're not going to talk about food groups. We're not going to talk about...
You would, because
I can't
be a teacher, right?
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what a teacher would do. You would want to talk about the food.
And most variety. You know,
most of us as parents during mealtimes, we never talk to our kids about the foods we're eating. We need to talk to them about the foods. That's why I say it's show and tell time.
Okay.
Your job as a teacher is to show your kids how to eat, be a good role model, and tell them about the food you're having. You better teach your subject, right?
Right.
So talk about the food groups. Talk about why you would eat liver and onions. Talk about what color it is. What size is it? What does it feel like in our mouth? Yes, absolutely.
Got it.
Want to do all of that stuff.
Okay. That's so I misunderstood.
Like, we do.
Yeah, I misunderstood thinking we don't want to talk about nutrition and macronutrients and all this kind of thing.
I was at that level, but great thing to think about.
But and what we don't want to do is force children to eat the right amounts.
Right. So to me, when I think about being a dietitian, yes, some dietitians are really good professors and would teach about macronutrients and micronutrients and vitamins and minerals. But when I think about most of us as parents being a dietitian, what most of us as parents think about when we are acting like dietitians is how much volume is my child eating? Are they getting enough protein? Have they gotten enough vitamin D, vitamin C? You know, we get into the minutiae of how much of these things has my child consumed.
Got it.
That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is teaching about nutrition.
Perfect. Absolutely. So, I mean, I see this as, yes, being the teacher versus holding the clipboard and ticking off the boxes without actual interaction with the child's brain.
Yeah. That's a really good analogy. Instead of you standing back and being an observer, right, mm-hmm. of how much of X, Y, or Z did they eat, you got to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get in there and engage with them. And if you want them to eat foods that have higher nutritional value, you need to explain to your kids why those foods have more nutritional value,
mm-hmm.
right? And why would you choose this food over this food?
Absolutely.
I'm glad you clarified that because how I said it may have made other people think similarly. And I want to be clear that I want families to talk about that. Now, I don't want them to just talk about the food. It would be great if they had a nice, normal conversation too about their day.
Absolutely.
But we want parents to try to keep that to pleasant topics, right?
Okay. Because we don't want to initiate that fight or flight, that adrenaline and stress response.
Exactly. Because emotions are contagious, right? And kids have little emotional antennae. So if you're talking about the fact that your older child had to go to the principal today, your younger child's going to get stressed by that, right?
Yeah.
Because everybody's going to be unhappy. People may be fighting. That's going to send them into fight or flight. Their adrenaline's going to go up. Their appetite's going to go off. And because they're not hungry anymore, they're just going to start misbehaving, right?
Sure. And, you know, when you were talking about how serving the food can initiate that sort of like visual sensory fight or flight when kids are nervous about new foods, I thought about the way sometimes I serve food, which is, come on, guys, get to the table. We got to go. And I'm
got people to see.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how many times I think across the country are meals served in a very stressful way, either because we're under time pressure or because mom's just cranky, raising mom's hand right now because it's the end of the day and I'm just done.
Right.
So I serve the food with anger instead of love. And I'm just sitting here like melting into a puddle thinking, I'm literally hurting my kid's digestion when I do that.
And that family style serving, especially when you give them permission, if they're not ready to eat it, they can just leave it on their plate and learn about it. That's what you would say. It's okay if you're not ready to eat it. We can at least learn about it. And whether it goes on the plate or whether it goes on the placemat, the fact you're teaching them and giving them permission to move the food away from themselves onto the learning plate, for example, means they don't have to move themselves away from the food.
Yeah.
And it slows the process down enough that it doesn't send them into that fight or flight. Like when you give them a whole plate of food and there's something like liver and onions on it.
Yep.
They're going to be like,
You know, there's the implied expectation that I not only do I have to eat it, I have to eat it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, when we think about what can we do as parents to really help our kids,
mm-hmm.
get them in a posturally stable position, be a good role model, have a good routine to the meal times is what we want to think about. And be a fun teacher. Be a fun teacher. And because if you're not enjoying the meal, they're not going to enjoy it either.
That is very true. Now, I have a practical question. I'm kind of known for like distilling things into like, what's the practical thing that busy parents can do without going crazy? Yep. And so when I hear about family style eating and special ladles and bowls, I see my dishes doubling.
Yes.
And if I had a super picky eater, I would be happy to do that. But since I don't necessarily, is it still a good idea? Like if the kids are at least serving themselves from the stove or the counter, like buffet style, or is that?
Yeah, okay. that would be a way to do it as well.
Right? Okay, good. This is my job. Make it easier for family.
You've got that exposure, yes. Right? And they have a choice to approach the food or step back from the food.
Okay.
You're doing a buffet, you get to make that choice. But part of going through a buffet style, whether it's at home or actual buffet, mm-hmm. is you get exposed to those other foods, right? The disadvantage of the buffet style is they only get the visual exposure.
Whereas if it's like too hot and they can't serve themselves, yeah.
Well, right. But let's say you're doing a buffet style and you're doing taco night and they skip over the avocado because they don't want to add that to their plate. They only get visual learning about avocado. Whereas if you family style serve a plate of avocado and they're supposed to put a piece on their plate, it depends on if in your buffet, you would request that they put a piece on their plate or not.
Okay. So you would definitely require every single item, even the toppings, to make at least a drop on the plate.
Somewhere on the plate. Yeah.
That's fabulous. Okay.
Yeah. That's how you would make it more equivalent to the family style serving. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about what's real, right? I've just given you what's ideal. We got to start with what's real.
Amen.
And what's real for most of us is there's no way we're going to sit down and do family style serving at breakfast. We got to get people out the door. We got lunches we're trying to put together. You know, our 8-year-old reminds us we're supposed to be doing school snack today, which we haven't prepared. I mean, breakfast is really challenging. So maybe all you can do is after school snack and dinner, right? And as an adult, if you want your child to have a healthier after-school snack, you should be sitting down and having a healthier after-school snack with your child, right? Because if you're in the kitchen not eating that new food, they're not going to eat it, are they? So it's okay if you just sit down and have a bite or two of some carrots, right? But at least and be a good role model. You know, so if families can do, maybe for your family, you can only do the family style serving at dinner. That's okay. That still gives your child one opportunity to learn about new foods in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. One of the phrases we use just to give parents, I like to give parents phrases because our brains are so full. Sometimes we don't know what to say. We're thinking too much, right? Our brains are done. And so one of the things we say is, would you like a serving or a taste? Okay. Like a taster or a serving? And then that allows the child to, you know, if they're too young to serve themselves, or if they've passed it over, you know, my bigger kids will not serve themselves. I'll say, oh, you missed the Brussels sprouts. Did you want a serving or a taste of that?
Yep. And I like that phrasing that you use. Sometimes what families have is what they call a no thank you plate or a no thank you bite. The problem with labeling it as a no thank you plate or no thank you bite is to children, no thank you, if I've done it once, means I never have to do it ever again in my lifetime. So having no thank you bites, no thank you plates actually close the cognitive doors.
Okay.
And so asking them, do you want a serving or a taste, and not having a label associated with it is really key.
Okay.
Really key.
Yeah, I'm like literally taking notes like, oh, take the no thank you bite out of the presentation. Because here, you know, it's my phrase, a serving or a taste. It's what we say. But in my presentation, I still say, yeah, make sure you do a no thank you bite.
No.
No thank yous.
Young children, no thank you means if I do it, I never ever have to do it again.
Sure. It's an end. Yeah, it's an ending word. And it's a negative phrase.
Right, right.
First taste. I hear a lot of first taste bites. You need to take a first taste bite. I like that one too.
Uh-huh. But what do you do if your child really and truly can't take a bite?
Well, I know what I tell people. What did I tell? Well, I call it the SALT approach, SLT. You can smell it, lick it, or taste it.
Okay.
And so at least the smelling is outside of like the zone of your actual mouth.
I think that's great. I think you're including smell as part of the taste and all they can do is smell it. That's great. That's great. Yeah. Because you're not forcing them to do something that they can't really and truly handle. And one of the problems when we make our children taste things and they have a really bad reaction to the taste is what we've just taught them is that food is bad. And we've just given them what we would call in the field an aversive learning experience about that food. Whereas if we slow it down and let them go at their own pace, they're going to be more likely to take a taste and be ready for it and manage it.
Yeah.
And so the nice thing about having smell as part of your taste is smell is an introductory way to get a taste because we actually have scent receptors in the back of our throat.
Yeah.
And so when you smell things, you're actually also tasting them.
Right.
And that's why when you go to the movie theater and you think, wow, I can almost taste the buttered popcorn. Actually, you are tasting the buttered popcorn.
Without it going to your hips. It's perfect.
Yeah. So, I think that that's a great way to handle it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a forced bite is the opposite of this win-win-win. It's a lose-lose because not only are you creating the power struggle, you're making a psychological issue between the parent and the child, but you're actually shooting yourself in the foot on that food being accepted ever, it sounds like.
Right. Right. And
eggs.
And because you've sent up their adrenaline, turned off their appetite, and their GI system on top of it.
Right. Whatever they do eat is not being digested. So you might as well just throw it away.
Yeah.
Sheesh.
Yeah. It's so hard as parents because we want so badly for our children to eat healthy and grow well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to not let that really good desire that we have as parents set us up to do something that's not helpful for our kids, right?
Yeah, and that's perfect. Yeah. The last question I always ask is just, I mean, especially sometimes we feel overwhelmed with so much information and we feel like there's this standard we have to reach. So like, if you just talk to parents' hearts, what do you want us to remember most of all?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, go for real. Start it real. We know there's ideal up here, but we got to start with what's real and work your way to ideal one teeny tiny step at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the one thing from today you think you can do easily and do that one thing and then tuck the other ones in the back of your head and pull them out when you're ready to do those.
Sounds good. Well, such fabulous information. I just really appreciate it. And I'm honored to share, you know, your worksheet with our students, our families here, and really honored to be part of your program because I know that you're helping kids in such fabulous ways. So thank you for being here.
And obviously, thank you for the work that you do because we find that it really helps our kids as well.
Wonderful. Well, we are a good team and audience. Yeah. We've got more where this came from. So definitely come back here next week for another edition of the Healthy Parenting Connector.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank you, my friends, for listening to another episode of the Healthy Parenting Handbook. Remember that you can get the show notes and that printable Problem Feeders versus Picky Eaters chart at kidscookrealfood.com/009 for episode 9. Also, that was a ton of information, and I have repackaged a lot of that along with simple action steps in the No More Picky Eating Challenge. We run that a couple times a year, but you can always get on the wait list. Go to kidscookrealfood.com/free challenge.